This is a special recording of Taste Matters, part of a series in conjunction with the opening of the Next World's Fair, Expo Milano 2015, where the U.S. will be participating with the USA Pavilion, themed American Food 2.0, United to Feed the Planet.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And as you know, if you've been listening along, we've been doing a series, a special series of Taste Matters dedicated specifically to the Next World's Fair. That's Expo Milano 2015, where the James Beard Foundation, the International Culinary Center, and the American Chamber of Commerce in Italy are putting together the American Pavilion. Now, the reason that we're talking about this on Heritage Radio Network and on Taste Matters in particular is because the theme of the fair, for the first time in the 150-plus year history of World's Fairs, is food, more specifically, feeding the planet energy for life. And so within that theme, each country, there are 147 participating countries and other organizations at the World's Fair, but each of them is contributing in some way to the conversation of how we will feed 9 billion people come 2050, when the Earth will be a crowded and hungry place. And the American Pavilion, no question there, is going to take on that topic first. You know, in the way that America takes on all sorts of topics in a bold and robust way. The theme of our American Pavilion is American Food 2.0, United to Feed the Planet. And what we intend to present there, as you've heard if you've been listening to this series, is an exploration of the unique contribution and perspective and innovations and entrepreneurship and all sorts of American qualities and characteristics that will be able to contribute to that global conversation. And as we move our way through the pavilion, we've heard from our architect, James Bieber. We've heard from our exhibition designers at Think Design. And today, I'm really excited to have in the studio with me the designers of a particularly attractive and interesting and complicated aspect of the American Pavilion, and that is a vertical farm. Now, this is not just a decorative wall that you see if you travel around the country, especially in Europe and France. I see a lot of pretty things growing on the sides of buildings. This will be a pretty thing growing on the side of our building, but it actually will be the side of our building, and it will be a harvestable farm, a representation of agriculture in America, past, present, and future, the size of a football field turned on its side. And the people who are making that farm possible, and who are making it not just possible, but actually poignant and a contribution to the larger conversation about food feeding the future, are with me today, Susanna Drake and Brett Siemens from D-Land Studios, a landscape architecture firm. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's start. Where do we start? Let's start, Susanna. Let's just start at the beginning. Like, why are we growing things on the side of a building, and what do you hope to show?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting as the United States has developed. You know, we've moved from a situation of having smaller scale farms to having larger scale farms, and as a result, there are farming practices that don't necessarily enable smaller scale farmers to enter the practice of farming. And so I think one of the opportunities that this affords is for people who want to farm on a smaller scale to actually do this kind of agricultural practice. And for instance, we met a man named Hayden Christensen, who is this kid who grew up on a farm out in Wyoming, and he wanted to be a farmer, but he couldn't afford to buy land. And, you know, his parents probably, you know, historically, or his grandparents probably had a quarter section of land out in the American West, but he couldn't afford to do that. And so he actually is using this new technology that we're using on the green wall system to have a couple of greenhouses and to grow very high value products and bring them to the Whole Foods near his greenhouses and sell them and actually make a profit and make a living as a small scale farmer.
So it's interesting because I think in the perception of the world, America is the place with all of the land, you know, and it, certainly historically the way that we've lived on this land has been that it's an unlimited resource, more or less. Obviously, we know that's not really true. So when I think of Wyoming, I think of vast tracts of land that you could grow anything you might want. But vertical is more viable at a certain scale or for a certain startup.
The vertical is. It's funny. It is kind of counterintuitive because it does seem like our land is a limitless resource here. But the control of that land is complicated, mm-hmm. right? So I think that it's not only a financial issue of the economics of the farming. I think it's also the other opportunity that it provides is for the freshest vegetables to actually be delivered to market in a different way. One of the things I found really unique about Hayden's practice is that he is bringing these towers directly into the supermarket so that people in the markets are actually harvesting their own food on site. So the plants are living in the supermarket or in the Whole Foods and then, or, you know, whatever market it is. And you get, you know, the greatest level of freshness that's possible.
Well. Brett, why don't you, let's take a step back, and since this is radio and not video, why don't you describe what we're talking about, what this the wall itself will look like and how it might work?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a 7,000-square-foot green wall that's about 300 feet by 30 feet, and it's located 15 feet off the ground. So it presented some complexity when we thought about what is the system that would best be able to grow and harvest crops on the wall. So we searched high and low, and we ended up finding what we felt was a very ideal system that could be supported weight-wise by the structure of the pavilion itself. And so we found this this company out in Wyoming called Bright Agrotech, and the owner, Nate Story, is this amazing, you know, American, perfectly, you know, fantastic ingenuity story, and he's an agronomist. And so he's worked for many years in developing this system of a series of towers. They're called Zip Grow Towers. And the towers are a hydroponic system where water is irrigated through the towers that the crops are growing in. And so it's an entire system that we're looking at. It's not a soil-based system completely. And it has everything to do with feeding nutrients into the water system and, you know, irrigating it through these towers. And so we have a series of almost 1,500 four-foot towers that are hung on this wall that will be sown, germinated in outside greenhouses, then moved the plugs into these towers and grown to maturity, and then actually hung on the wall. And throughout the 6 months of the expo, we will be able to harvest up to 52 times throughout the entire, you know, process. And so it's quite a complex sort of, wow, you know, program that we've established. But it is a system that we feel, you know, best sort of explains the new technologies out there for growing food.
And I think it's a very highly productive system. And one of the things that we're really trying to develop within the green wall is this idea that the pairing of particular plants can actually make them more productive. So, you know, we're going back to ideas about traditional agriculture and thinking about how that can actually make the plants grow better. And we were talking about this on the way here, right, so I wanted to bring it up.
Yeah, I think conceptually what we thought the best way for people to actually really understand what we're doing on the wall is we wanted to look at the history of agriculture in the U.S. and even go back as far as the indigenous people, the Native American Indians, and how they grew crops. And there's a lot to learn from them and how they actually were able to make success stories of food production in our country. And so what we're doing is we're actually looking at the most sustainable land use farming practices out there and really trying to emulate that on the wall. So it has everything to do with intercropping, polycropping, companion planting, contour plantings. So for instance, on our wall, if we were to look at companion planting, companion planting is really interesting because it's the type of planting you do where one plant actually assists the growing of another plant. And what that has to do with providing beneficial opportunities for getting the right kind of insects to come in. It also repels certain pests, as well as it provides special nutrients for the soil that some plants need that can feed off other plants. And so kind of to give you an example, on our wall, we have peppers. Peppers require high humidity to grow. And so you achieve high humidity by being able to plant it next to a crop that is fuller and provides sort of a certain amount of coverage, therefore increasing the humidity. So we have our peppers being planted next to our basil and our okra that are very heavy, dense, leafy crops.
Sounds like a side dish, just waiting to cook.
Right? Exactly, exactly.
Need a lot of wall.
And we had to be a little wary, too, because there's other crops like fennel that does not like to grow next to a lot of things. And so if you grow fennel next to cilantro, they tend to cross-pollinate with each other and therefore ruin the entire taste. So we had to be very careful about what we could plant next to each other and what we could plant next to each other. Basil, mint, rosemary, and sage are often used to repel slugs and moss, and which are prevalent in cabbage growth. So we've planted those crops next to the cabbage. So in effect, we're creating this whole entire sustainable system.
Has anything like this been done before that you know of?
I mean, it's been done on terra firma,
right.
But it's never been done on scale.
No terra, not firma.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Well, I think even within some of the larger agricultural systems that Nate Story had described, and sorry, I sort of jumped into the weeds before explaining the overall system, but because Nate actually is using, or sorry, Hayden Christensen is using Nate's system. I think that the crop systems that they're developing tend to be more or less integrated. You know, what we've created is really an exposition of a new kind of interplanting that is fairly, well, I think it is unique.
Wow. So when you look back on the history of agriculture, obviously farming is a topic on this particular radio station, but in general food system conversations globally, what would you say are some of the positive advancements, and what are some of the challenges that America's approach to agriculture has presented as you've sort of surveyed it to try to create a story to tell at the expo?
Well, I think the fact that it's a recirculating system of this hydroponic system is actually important as a lesson, because we've historically with modern agricultural systems had a tendency to put resources into the land that then can sort of flush through it. And I think that with revisions to modern agricultural systems, there are going to be and are certainly attempts to make a more holistic system where the resources that are put in actually enrich and then feed back into more of a loop. And I think that what our system is showing is kind of a microcosm of that future loop that can happen. Mm-hmm. And it certainly can happen on a larger scale in terms of providing more kinds of surfaces for agriculture to happen. But I think it's also just a really important lesson in terms of thinking more holistically about our use of resources in general. And I think it's also, it speaks to the idea that with enhanced technology, we can actually make these improvements, that we're not going to sort of throw out the old systems. We're going to think about how new technology can actually help to enhance some of our older ideas about agricultural practices.
I'd like to pick up that thread a little bit, because I do think that when we think of agriculture, there is a backlash against technology, and I think often that's directed against, let's say, genetic engineering as an example of a technology that people are wary of, skeptical of. But technology on the farm in general has actually made tremendous advancements and helped in many different ways. Could we Brett, you want to give us a few thoughts about that, about technology's role there? Because what you are building is a very technologically sophisticated farm, although it's actually quite simple in concept. To execute is technologically challenging.
Right. I mean, advances in technology with farming are, you know, kind of amazing when you start thinking about the industrial age, too. And, you know, if you fly over the Midwest, anywhere west of the Appalachians, you get this amazing grid system that has been established. And it dates back to 1785 with the Land Ordinance Act. And you start looking, it's sort of the division, the selling and the settling of land and westward expansion. And so you start looking at this, and everything was divided up equally into these squares. And so I feel like even looking at the technology, you know, the combines and ways to actually harvest, it's all oriented around this grid system. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably our first sort of technological advances in terms right. of agriculture.
And you really notice that when you fly into Milan, let's say, and you go over the land, it just doesn't look like America down there, right? When you look at the
right, exactly.
land, it's more patchwork, it's less defined.
Well, yeah.
And some of those patterns in other places have more to do with the geography. And in the United States, you know, the country was divided up into a grid without any recognition of the geography. So one of the things I think we're trying to look at with this wall system is how to kind of transcend or suggest that if we are growing on the land, the differences in the topography actually create different microclimates, which produce different situations, which will grow certain crops better. Mm. And yeah, so it's kind of a, you know, it's challenging to actually try to represent some of these ideas through our green wall, but it's another sort of pedagogic mission of what we're trying to achieve in the expo. And it may end up being more expressed by the think team on the inside. But it's definitely a goal.
We're going to take a quick break. I'm talking with D-Land Studios, who are the landscape architects working on the vertical farm of the American Pavilion at the next World's Fair. You're listening to Taste Matters. Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and today we are continuing our conversation about the American Pavilion at the next World's Fair in Milan, Expo Milano 2015. The World's Fair opens May 1st, and it runs through October 31st. That's 6 months of all sorts of programs and programming about food, about culture, about cultural exchange, all sorts of things that 147 participating countries and other organizations are going to bring to Milan in this conversation about how we will feed the future. I'm talking today with Susanna Drake and Brett Siemens of D-Land Studios, who are the landscape architects who will be producing the vertical farm, 100-meter, 100-yard, football field-size, vertical growing wall, hydroponic, technologically sophisticated. We didn't even talk about the fact that it's going to move to the sun in some ways. But since we're the eyes are rolling and one wonders how that'll all happen, although we've seen the prototypes working. But I wanted, so we're going from May to October. That's a bunch of seasons in there, especially in Italy, in Milan. And so I want to talk about what's actually growing on this thing and what's going to happen with that stuff.
Well, I want to just, I think it's going to be actually very beautiful to watch the transformation of the wall over time. And Brett, I want you to describe some of the more specific aspects of that.
But. Yeah, I'd be happy to. We have been in a relationship now with an heirloom seed company out of Missouri called Baker Creek Seeds, and they have been incredibly helpful in really helping us to determine the types of crops that we're planting on the wall, especially with Nate Story, who is the inventor of this product. And so we wanted to be able to approach this as sort of a more fully integrated approach to food. So we're going to be growing an assortment of grains, vegetables, and herbs on the wall. Now, you might imagine that there are some things that are really difficult to grow on the wall. We can't grow corn because it's such a vertical crop.
Pumpkins, I think, would be dangerous.
Pumpkins would be dangerous.
Tomatoes would be messy.
Right. You know, don't stand below the wall.
Right. Pumpkin falling zone. Life. Falling zone, right.
Exactly. So, and we also wanted to be able to use things that have a proven track record in this system. Mm. And so what we came up with were 42 different varieties of crops. Oh. So it's quite extensive. And so it's all been really interesting. We are planting everything from mint to basil to cilantro. And even we're actually planting barley and rye on the wall, which take on these most amazing sort of furry-like creature, you know, sort of, you know, characteristics when they're actually fully grown in these towers. But it's really interesting because all of these seeds, and the story of seeds is really interesting because they're handed down from generation to generation, and there are these amazing stories that are out there that almost seem folklore-ish. Hmm. And so what we've tried to do is we tried to get an amazing breadth and diversity of seeds and heirloom seeds that tell these amazing stories about our country and about how we were founded. So, for instance, we're planting something called fish peppers, and it is an African-American heirloom pre-1947 that was developed outside of Philadelphia and Baltimore, and it was used to actually to provide a little bit of spice to fish cooking.
Really?
So
that's specific. Right?
That's specific, yeah. And so we get these amazing seed stories that are out there. We even have this special cucumber called the Sully Byler cucumber that was developed by an Amish Mennonite church in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Wow. So I want to pick up on something that I think is interesting that you said, that these are heirloom seeds, and then you told me that at some point in time they were developed. And I think that some people think that heirloom seeds sort of landed after the Big Bang, or, you know, God put through them, scattered them around the earth. So what does that mean? What does developing a seed mean? What does heirloom mean in the context of seeds? And is it meaningful only against seeds developed to produce large-scale agriculture, or genetically engineered seeds, or what? Tell me about seeds. Talk about seeds.
I mean, it's a really interesting story. Many of the heirloom seeds are more sort of antique, ancient seeds, and they're passed on from generation to generation. And a lot of what happened, I believe, is it just happens through cross-pollination of some of these seeds. If you have one type of bean that's planted next to another variety of bean, if they cross-pollinate, they start combining their genes together, and they create a whole new type of seed. And so that's really fascinating.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and so that's how they came up with the fish peppers,
right.
was a Mexican, I believe, habanero with a different type of pepper.
And it fell into the fish soup, and they were like, wow, this is good. Let's call it a fish pepper.
Exactly, right. Okay. Exactly.
I think some of it also relates to just which plants did best in the garden. Mm. Like you would watch. It's you know, genetic or you know, this kind of genetic engineering, you know, goes back to just observation.
Right.
It can be very elemental, just seeing, you know, which pepper is least is the most resistant to disease, or which one is growing the largest corn, or which one is growing the greatest crop of tomatoes. And the farmer would watch, and then they'd save those seeds. So, you know, over time, you'd get a really highly productive seed bank. Mm. And then some of those banks we found were kind of lost at one point, and some of the American banks were lost, but there were sort of, they were stored in kind of remote places. We've really learned a lot about where these seeds have gone over time and how they've migrated, say, back to Europe and then back to the United States now with more awareness of the importance of seeds.
Well, I actually recall reading a fascinating story. It's interesting that this whole project is happening in Italy, which I don't think is an accident that Italians have chosen this theme and that everyone is engaged in this way. But I remember an article about tomatoes in Naples that had been grown for so many generations in individual families' backyards that they were actually distinct varietals of tomatoes. And this was a story that about losing that variety of tomatoes because the kids didn't want them or weren't going to grow the seeds anymore, and what would happen to the Neapolitan tomato diversity. And that's sort of a very microcosmic story about what's going on more largely in the world due to different forces of production. So let's talk, since these will air, this show is on before the expo. What are your biggest fears and hopes about this project? What keeps you up at night? And what are you excited to see come to fruition? Just dead silence on the air.
I don't know. I mean, I know that there's a lot. It's challenging when you're working with things that grow.
Right.
I mean, this is a farm, and you know, we're creating a completely new, unprecedented kind of system. So what keeps us up at night is, you know, trying to make sure that all the right procedures are followed and to make it successful. You know, ultimately, we think it'll work.
Well, I mean, when you plant crops on the ground in a farm, you don't really know what's going to happen that season. I mean,
except that, you know, in a farm you've tended the land, you know, you've done everything you can. I mean, we're doing everything we can to ensure the success of the wall. And we're working with a lot of experts to make sure it will.
We've pulled in local agronomists and a nursery to help us maintain and operate this entire system, because as you imagine, you can't grow a plant overnight. So we're going to start production the end of January.
Wow.
And so when it opens in May, we're going to have this fully functioning, green, beautiful wall of different colors and textures and plants. And so the thing that we have to rely on our Milan counterparts is to get a better understanding of the climate. We have to install this in March, the very end of March, and they keep telling us that sometimes it snows in March. And so for us, you know, we've had to adjust our crop planting for that shoulder season. So we take off the wall, the more delicate sort of crops. So that has to do with all the fruiting crops. So we're taking off the eggplant and the cucumbers and all the peppers, and we're replacing them with much more hardy crops. And so when the season improves and the sun comes out and the climate is great, we'll then actually go back to our original plan. So in a way, we're sort of, you know, we're being held captive by, you know, Mother Nature, but we're trying to adjust as best as we can. And that's the exciting thing about it, because it's ever evolving.
And I think, you know, I grew up on a farm in Vermont, and we experienced these issues of that late snow or the late frost, or, you know, the deer come in and eat all your peas, and so you have to replant. I think the issue is that this is a public exposition, and, you know, we've developed a very, very rigorous and specific planting plan for when the seeds are sown and how they're going to be transplanted, and then how the towers are each going to be placed up on the wall. And while we've established a whole series of fail-safe systems, ultimately it has to look good all the time, 24/7, you know, as soon as it goes up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a concern because we are dealing with living things, and we're dealing with potential environmental change or environmental what's the word I'm looking for?
Influences, right.
Or,
yeah. Well, and I'll remind everyone, because of course you've heard different aspects of this. This is just one piece of a very large, complicated pavilion in a very large, complicated and logistically challenging World's Fair. But I think, you know, if you've done anything about research or read anything about World's Fairs, you know that that's part of the excitement and the adrenaline that builds in anticipation, and what people come to see is how all of it comes together in the end. And we're very excited to see how all of your work and planning and strategizing and adapting will pay off. So thank you for sharing some of the background with us. Thanks for joining us here in Brooklyn.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And if you're listening and you want to see more or learn more, go to usapavilion2015.net. That's our website. You can sign up. There's a blog there. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or sign up to receive our electronic newsletter, where you will see pictures of progress and tests and prototypes. And eventually you'll see all the exciting things that will be happening in Milan. Better yet, come see them in person and join us there.
And have a salad.
And have a salad. We'll have a lot of produce. If it all goes according to plan, there'll be a lot to eat. Thanks for listening. This is Taste Matters. We'll be back soon.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.